All members, a few members that are here. Mr. Coleman, I believe, is actually on our list first, because if you look at the agenda here, a lot of these projects, some aren't on the cutoff where the governor's bonding proposal would reach down. Mr. Coleman will tell us that, but many of these will be getting funding if the $30 million proposed in the governor's bonding right now for PFA stays in, and I believe $10 million, is it, for West and the... Or, right. So, Mr. Coleman, why don't you come up and talk a little bit about your authority, what you do and where you think you're going to be, and give us a little presentation. And I don't intend members to hear these, just move them on, because most of them, as I said, are on the list, and Representative Hausman can deal with those that aren't, I guess. Welcome to the committee.
Committee members, you should have a packet like this that we provided. And I think if I start going through that, it'll kind of lay out the program a little bit, how it works, and then all the priority lists that are in there. And I think we did a one-page spreadsheet, but we still got projects to add probably to it. This kind of summarizes where they're at. But if you found that, just briefly want to discuss the authority, the structure. It's really six different agencies, commissioners that make up the board. The health, transportation, PCA, finance, agriculture, and deeds, and Commissioner McElroy is the chair of it. We operate many programs. The two key ones are the Drinking Water Revolving Loan Fund and the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund that do most of the work. We also have a small transportation revolving loan fund, a methylab cleanup revolving loan fund, a county credit enhancement program that allows counties to issue AAA rated debt for criminal justice facilities and social service buildings. So it's related to community finance. We tend to get involved with it. The governor's bonding request for the PFA is $30 million in state matching funds. $24 million of that is for clean water to do wastewater projects. $6 million of that is for drinking water. The wastewater is a more of a one-to-one match. We're anticipating $12 million a year from the federal government. The legal minimum is 1-5, so we are requesting more. The governor recommends more, because the more money we get, further down the list we go. Historically, we've gotten a 1-5, and then 2 years ago, when we were getting $19 million a year from the federal government, the governor recommended, and we received $38 million, which was a 1-1. We're going to continue that because the demand is so great. On the drinking water program, we're only asking for a 1-5 because there is adequate funding between the state and federal funds to address all the high priority stuff, all the health and safety issues, plus further down in the list. So it pretty much covers the demand out there for projects to proceed, where the wastewater, there's a lot more projects than we have money to go. The second priority is the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, or WIF, and that program is designed to address the funding gaps for the high-cost projects. So as we go down the list, either with the Revolving Loan Fund, the Clean Water Fund, or we work with USDA Rural Development, they go down our list as well and work with the real small low-income communities, and they offer loan grant. The WIF program will either provide a matching grant with Rural Development when they do the project, or when we're funding it, it's a 0% loan deferred for 20 years, and then when the Clean Water Revolving Loan Fund is paid off, then they start repaying the WIF program. And the reason we do that is because Rural Development offers 40-year loans, and we can only offer 30-year, so it puts cities on the same playing field, so to speak. With the WIF, they stretch those loans out 40 years. So that's kind of how it works. We are proposing a policy change in that. When the program was set up, we did not take into account existing debt for wastewater. So when we set the threshold of 5% of median household income, we were thinking brand new wastewater systems, not thinking of cities that have phased projects, like 1, 2, 3 phases, or cities that have recently built systems and then have new standards, so they've got to do major modifications to treatment plants, and we do have projects like that this year. And our feeling that 5% of market value is affordability level is fairly firm. So when you get cities, Litchfield is a prime example, they just opened or started using their new wastewater treatment plant in 01, and now they got stuck with some new standards, and part of that's related to the dairy company there and the pretreatment of the dairy byproducts in relationship to the impaired water, the TMDL program. So we are proposing to change the WIF program to take into account existing debt as one of the factors. And also the increase the share of the state match to USDA Rural Development. They are running short of grant funds, and we don't want to see the loan money they have turned back to the federal government. So we're going to increase the, or requesting to increase the amount of state funds to match their grant on a 35-65 basis instead of a 50-50 to keep the federal money in the state. Our third priority is the small community wastewater treatment program, and that's designed to keep the very small cities that are under PCA's permit threshold of 10,000 gallons per day on septic systems. So it's a voluntary program that the cities can apply, homeowners can participate. If they're willing to turn their system over to a city and have a city put in a septic system and give them a utility easement so they can pump it and maintain it, we'll provide a 50% grant and 50% loan. And if we have numerous communities with straight pipes, things like that, generally I think the average size community is around 15 to 20 homes participates in this. We do have a $100,000 general fund based corporation that we provide grants to cities to do the soil boring to make sure septics will work before they apply for the actual construction. So, but the idea is trying to do low cost, low tech solutions to these in small towns rather than sticking them with a municipal wastewater treatment when it's physically feasible. The fourth request is $2 million for the total daily maximum loan grant program. I keep saying loan. But it is a grant program. When a city is part of a TMDL or total daily maximum load study and there's a pollutant to reduce the pollutant in an impaired water allocated, and the city has to upgrade their wastewater treatment to meet their allocation of pollution reduction going into a body of water, this program provides a 6% grant for that. And the key to this program is it's an incentive to get cities to participate in that whole process so they don't get burnt on the end when it comes to allocating the pollutant loads. They're actual participants at the table and getting these studies done. This is an incentive there because if they do have to reduce the pollutants, there is some grant money to help them with that process. Eventually, this is going to be a very costly program, so I'm not sure how long it's going to last or what changes we're going to need in the future, but right now we have close to 400 cities that eventually are going to have to address some component of their wastewater treatment system to meet the 15 TMDLs that have already been done. And there's 50 in the process, or 50, more than 50 in the process of being done. So that list is going to get huge before it's all done. And I didn't mean to say just cities, but a lot of these may be townships with unincorporated communities and things like that, but government entities that need to do stuff. The Phosphorus Reduction Grant Program is a 75% grant for phosphorus reduction. It's a maximum grant of $500,000. And it's really designed to help address PCA's phosphorus standard. They're requiring most cities to meet the 1 milligram per liter threshold, in some cases even lower standard, depending on the body of water they discharge into and whether it's impaired water where phosphorus has been identified. And then our last request is a $100,000 general fund request in the bonding bill, and that is to help us get all the legal work and paperwork completed to put together a bond tour program. This would be a non-subsidized program, like unlike the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Fund. All we're going after is two things from the state. One, in the event of a default on part of a municipality, it would be an open appropriation from the general fund to pay the bondholders if there's money in the general fund, and the state aid intercept to intercept the state aid to pay off the bondholders. Now, since there's never been a default of a municipal GO bond in the state of Minnesota, it's pretty safe. There won't be, we're hoping, but we have a similar program with the counties, the County Credit Enhancement Program for jails and criminal justice facilities and social service buildings. And they have access to capital at a AAA rated through Moody's, or through Standard & Poor's, and a AA1 through Moody's. We want to get that same rating for municipalities to deal with infrastructure using this program, and we want to keep it low cost, so we're asking for $100,000 to get the legal documents in place, negotiate with the rating agencies if there's any underwriting criteria they want to follow, things like that, because it is opening it up a little bit. And we do not want to impact the state bond rating by doing this program. So those are the six proposals that we have in front of in the bonding bill. On the next page in the book is highlights the credit enhanced school bond program we're proposing and two changes to the LIFT program we're proposing. And then if we can get in behind the first tab, the wastewater one, we generally measure the benefit of the revolving loan fund by how much funds we save in interest costs. And we look at the market, and if a city could sell at a AAA rate in the marketplace, we compare the loan rate we provide with that rate and calculate the savings. So that's how the saving figures comes about. We've done $1.6 billion worth of loans, saved cities over $400 million in interest costs, calculating interest savings that way. The next page, I think, kind of tells the story overall. The big picture is the bar graph, like this. And the yellow lines are the requests we receive every year. The green line are the number dollar amount of the projects we finance every year. The blue line is the amount of federal funds we've gotten, and the red line is the state match funds that we've gotten. So if you want to look at how much we do given the state match dollars, that's a significant amount of projects. We saw a dip since 93, and that was primarily mostly infrastructure. I'd say a good chunk of infrastructure, not most, but a good chunk was being paid for by cities, in essence, because developers were building a lot of homes and tax bases were increasing, and the cities could finance on their own. They weren't coming to us. As soon as that housing boom started slowing down, you see the rapid increase in asking for assistance, and as the economy and the local budgets get squeezed, you see the rapid increase in requests from us. We tried this past year to fund more than we have ever. We anticipate about $210 to $220 million before the fiscal year is over. Trying to keep those construction workers employed. If you look at the next table,
Mr. Coleman, if I can stop you right there just for a second. So if we're looking at your bar graph and we see what was requested and what actually was done, do cities just get frustrated and drop off the list, or are we just constantly losing ground, or is it a combination of both? Because the request didn't really, it pretty much stayed level in, you know, 4, 5, 6, and 7, and shot up now estimated in 08. Is it catching up with us then, the folks that requested versus who was funded?
I wouldn't say they get frustrated and drop off the list. A lot of these projects, once they request funding, a lot of things happen to them. The permits get, and recently the permits have been getting tied up in court. I think in 06 you saw a rapid 05 and 06 saw rapid decline because of Annandale Maple Lake court case, put a crimp on about two-thirds of the state as far as getting permits for new facilities. So you saw a tremendous drop. They didn't get off the list. They stayed on there. As new projects got added, you saw the demand. Once they come in, we usually figure it's a two-year process, even though we ask them if they're going to proceed this year, and then we put them on what's the intended use plan, how we intend to use the funds in given year. What we found out is from the time they asked to get on that list to the time they actually do construction, it's about a two-year time frame. So the list is really a two-year running average. We add new ones every year, but it takes 2 years, and the ones we didn't do the previous year, we fund most of them the next year. The only problem is the amount of money we get in a given year dictates how far up and down we go on the list. And this year we stretched into the future capacity to try to do a little more than we normally do because the demand was greater than we normally did. But we can't afford to do that long term. We end up bankrupting ourselves by doing that. And we are a AAA rated entity, so we need to watch our revenue coverages and debt service coverage when we do these kind of things. Now, I'll try to explain that a little bit on the next graph. It's a line graph that shows you what we've done, very similar to the green bars, except on the tail end it shows the capacity. If we don't receive another penny from the state or federal government, our fund has the capacity to do about $70 million a year given the current subsidy we provide borrowers. And that's it. I mean, so we'd be able to address the top priority projects at a $70 million a year range, given the equity we've gotten in past state match and federal funds. If we get the $24 million the governor recommends over the six-year budget period in the governor's capital budget, we should be able to do $150 million a year for the next 6 years and then drop back down to that $70 million mark. If you want to know what, when we get an equity dollar in, what can we do with that dollar? We can, in essence, subsidize $4 worth of projects and meet all of our tests to maintain our AAA rating. But anyway, the $70 million, that's basis. From the money or equity, the difference between what we pay in debt service and the amount of revenues we have coming in from all the loans will allow us to make new loans of $70 million a year. So that shows you the impact. And whenever we go above that $150 million, that drops that $70 million down. You know, if we go up $10 million, it might drop that $70 million down a million. But it does drop, not dollar for dollar, but maybe one for 10, one for 12. Which is the nature of a long-term debt. So it's a constant balancing act when the authority draws that line every year, and we get a lot of pressure to do projects. Is what's the impact of drawing that line on the future capacities of funds? And we took a fairly big jump this year by opening the door to over $200 million worth of projects that did reduce our future capacity about $6 million. After that, you'll find the list of projects. I think the vast majority of bills that have been introduced are on the list. The wastewater one is the green one. The white sheet behind it is alphabetical listing, so trying to find the city that you're looking at. The alphabetical listing would be on the white sheet, and the brief project description and dollar amounts and things are on the green sheet. On the green sheet, the shaded lines are the projects we've already funded so far this year. So, and the reason you see a lot of low-priority projects funded is because we're doing the old project priority list. This is the last year of allowing them to carry over and get their project done, the ones that were in the fundable range back in 2006.
So, Mr. Coleman, with the governor's $30 million and the other things that he put in the bonding bill, I can't remember, the WIP was 10, I think, and that. Where do you get down to on the list?
We're shooting for a 45-point cutoff, which would be on the third page. And
so no munis?
Part of that depends on which project. Usually about half of them come forward. If we have a larger percentage come forward, we'd have to draw the cutoff line higher.
So you think like the new Munich then is what you're seeing there?
Yes.
On page 3 there.
Yes.
And only half of them you're anticipating apply.
Right.
So you should be able to fund everybody up above that point that applies.
Right. Everybody that applies up to that point, we give them the green light, knowing some of them are going to drag out into future years as sticker shock, permit issues. They tend to get in lawsuits from environmental groups that want higher standards and PCA permits. A variety of things slow projects down, but for the most part.
And the, like the $2 million TMDL and phosphorus that you've got in there, how do you mix that in with the blend here? I noticed some qualify their point system too.
They follow the priority system, and the first one is eligible going down the list. We earmark the money.
Is that a grant? Are those two grant programs?
Those are grant programs. So if we do the loan program, and then if there's a gap, the WIF provides that gap funding or addresses the high cost stuff to keep them affordable. The others are no means tests. They're just flat fixed percentage grants. And that's kind of why they're a lower priority for us, but still a priority.
So if we gave you, if the governor had $30 million, we gave you $40 million, where would you go on the list? Or wouldn't it work that way?
Well, again, we would put the additional money into wastewater, not drinking water. So talking $10 million additional, we would go $40 million further down the list is what we would do. Or maybe a little more, assuming some would drop off and some wouldn't.
So you'd prefer, if there was some extra money found, that it goes to WIF?
I would look at tough question. Going beyond the governor's budget, if we had $5 million on the table, I'd recommend doing WIF, because that would help us get down to that 45 point on the ones that need additional grant money to make it affordable. You know, if you're talking $10 million, I would recommend putting a 5 into the revolving fund, the clean water revolving fund, the state match, and then 5 into additional in the WIF. So split it.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cohen, as I look at this list, if the cutoff point is down to 45, the next one down is Pine City, and it's a $30 million bill.
Mm-hmm.
So that, how does that affect that $5 or $10 million more? Always is that one ominous.
Yeah, that would take a big chunk.
Okay. And I have one other question, Mr. Chair. I've been on this committee seems forever, but it's only been 8 or 10 years. And every year there seems to be a small city, small town, really an emergency need. Are we covering those with this or with any additional monies? Are there any of those emergencies out there?
I don't raise anything to the level of ASCOP a few years ago, which was kind of a unique situation, and they've been doing everything right for 20 years. Very low-income community and taking their time upgrading infrastructure, and then just got nailed with having to relocate a pond when all they thought they had to do was clean it out and do some riprap. So their $300,000 project turned into a $4.5 million project. There are some unique stories. You've probably heard some, and you'll hear some more, but nothing rising to that level. I mean, we have some projects that have the WIF program, for example, has a cap of $4 million. When we first created it, the idea was that anything over that should come to the legislature and justify why they need more money than that. And we used to include those projects in our WIF report every 2 years, but that language that required that in the WIF report was deleted along the way, so we quit doing it. But there are some cities that could use more funding because of the 5% of market value. like Wilmer, they got an $80 million project, 5% of market value is like $52 million. So, you know, if there was no cap on WIF, you know, they'd be eligible for $28 million worth of WIF. Litchfield, with, you know, if you take into account existing debt, they'd be up in the $8 million range with their new plan. So there are, you know, projects that are different, but nothing super extraordinary.
Thank you.
The drinking water program, very similar to the wastewater one. That program, we have adequate funding. The federal government allows us to do grants up to 10% of the federal allocation. So we do have a disadvantaged community grant program built into that. What triggers it is their actual health and safety reason for the need for the project. That is, they got arsenic or radiochemicals in the water, bacterial contamination, things like that, that have an urgent health need, then we can provide the disadvantaged community grant along with the loan. And that program, we use a criteria similar to rural development. We use 1.4% of median household income and then fund 80% of the cost over that with the disadvantaged community grant program, up to $500,000. Demand doesn't seem to be that great for the program, that we need additional funds or additional program for it. Seems to do all the priority projects. And behind the tab, you'll see the WIF report. There's some more information there. And if we modify the WIF program, it kind of shows you the cumulative totals for the WIF need. You can go down the list on the very back pages of the report. I think that's the most telling story. The only thing that doesn't show up very well is the shaded areas that we've already funded or where funds have been allocated already. We also, in the governor's bonding bill, we have in the rider language, we're requesting to allow us to use $2 million for the corrective action projects that we've dealt with the last two bonding bills, where a short period of time we had numerous projects when Governor Ventura vetoed the WIF funding, $30 million worth of WIF funding. That was the same time period the USDA got $50 million of funds from the one-time shot to do wastewater projects, and we're counting on that money to match. And when that money got vetoed, they ended up cutting the projects, so they ended up building a whole lot of projects real cheaply, and we had about a dozen of them that didn't work because they were penny pinched to death. So the last two bonding bills, we've tried to fund those projects, and we've got a couple that still need some assistance, and we're running short of money. So we're asking for $2 million to do those projects that were listed in the 05 legislation.
How far down the list do you go with the existing funds, and if you get that on the drinking water list?
We've had a cutoff of 10 points. We're thinking of dropping it down to 7-point projects.
So where would we be there?
Almost to the complete bottom of the list. We have very few. Most of the projects that have actually dropped off or given up that have ranked lesser than that.
Any other questions, then? You're presenting the governor's speech proposal to, or the commissioner?
I will. I'll help Dan with a few of the programs that I'm working on, but I'll let him do the speaking because I got a sore throat. Killing.
Well, members, if you look at your agenda list, and I'm just going to have whoever wants to make a motion, we have to add Representative Anderson's bill here, House Bill 1944. To the list because we inadvertently left him off. I apologize to Clearwater Mayor, Mayor Monk out there. Also, what happens in a situation like Clearwater where they're on the list for a loan but a bill's put in for a grant?
Yeah,
Representative Anderson did.
Well, Clearwater, you might want to actually ask them to briefly comment. So that's one of the communities that's unique in a sense that they're in a growth corridor along the Interstate 94, Highway 10. They got one city's on one side of the river and the other's on the other. They work together. But because of the land values in that town are very high, 5% of market value would put sewer fees in the $95 a month range. And the income isn't all that great in the community. So that's one of the communities that kind of doesn't fit our mold.
But is there a formula or something you can do then to address that type of a problem?
If the growth occurs that they plan on growing, that the rates would drop down to $50 a month. I mean, the unfortunate thing is when you have $90, $95 a month sewer rain bills, you kind of wonder if that growth is going to occur that they're building into the system. So it's a catch-22. And we don't have any good answers. You know, to change our WIF formula for that one circumstance would be kind of drastic. So.
How about a special fund to address something like that where you don't change the formula, but there's the discretion?
That would, in their case, it would work.
Okay. Then Representative Gunster, who's a spendthrift that he has, moved bills 870 through 3001, including House Bill 1944, which isn't on the list. Any other questions for possible inclusion in the bill, which we'll discuss how we're going to do that on Thursday night later? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Commissioner, come on up then. Briefly, Commissioner, we still have the mayor here. I see the mayor from St. Paul is here, or he was. Maybe. Oh, there he is. Mayor Coleman.
I can be brief, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dan McElroy, the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, which everyone refers to, of course, as the acronym as D. Mr. Chairman, there's a one-page handout in members' packets that has on the Blue Positively Minnesota spread ahead. Now, that's the PFA one. It's one that looks like this.
Okay.
A couple of members have found it. There are five items in the governor's budget recommendation that are proposed to come to the department. Three of them are represented by bills that are before you. And those are the three that are Department of Employment and Economic Development programs. Let me start with those. The redevelopment grant program is, I think the bill author is Representative Moe, and I thank him for his willingness to carry this bill. The redevelopment grant program assists in recycling essentially land that has previously been used largely for industrial purposes. It's allocated 50% in Greater Minnesota and 50% in the metropolitan area. It has been used for a wide variety of projects, from very large projects like tennis and papery development in Little Falls, a wide variety of programs by the St. Paul Port Authority and the City of Minneapolis, to some relatively small programs like the Swift plant in Tracy. It has been a part of bonding bills going back, I suspect, 20 years. The decision was made by the legislature in 2006, I believe, to allocate 50% to Greater Minnesota and 50% to the metropolitan area. It has been competitive. The demand probably exceeds the $20 million recommendation, but it has. We track the amount of private investments that are made as a result of redevelopment projects and the number of jobs created. And it's been a very productive program. It's one for which we hear a great deal of community support. The second proposal in the governor's bonding initiative is represented in a bill that Representative Mahoney is carrying. It's the Vital Signs Business Development Public Infrastructure Program. The governor's recommending $10 million. I believe Representative Mahoney put his bill in at $20 million. We appreciate that, or understand it anyway. It is a fairly flexible appropriation or fairly flexible bonding program. It can be used for traditional economic development infrastructure like roads, sewer, and water. But it's broader than that. It could be used for telecommunications, bridges, parking ramps, business incubator facilities. It is a competitive grant program. There has been significant demand for projects that have been funded and included projects in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester. We know there is a demand in additional communities around the state. The third deed program that is in the governor's recommendation is the Greater Minnesota Public Economic Development Public Infrastructure Program. By law, this is for investment outside the metropolitan area. It provides competitive matching grants of up to $1 million. Traditionally, they have been used for industrial park development and have been successful in a wide range of cities around the state. They can also be used for things like sewer extensions. A township in Douglas County outside of Alexandria, Carlos Township, used one of these grants to build a water tower that made possible the expansion of a packaging equipment company and allowed us to win a competition with a town in Ohio to bring that development to the Twin Cities. The city of Wyoming has the money that we have from a previous public infrastructure grant to bring a manufacturing company from Osceola, Wisconsin. We get excited about those. So the public infrastructure program in Greater Minnesota has been successful. It's about a 10-year-old program, and it has been funded at levels smaller than this grant. Like $20 million, however, would begin to meet the needs. We would anticipate substantially more applications for this amount of money than we have had in the past. Cities and economic development authorities and county economic developers work together to make economic infrastructure applications. And one of the, I think, benefits of this program is the amount of collaboration it creates between local and municipal governments. The governor also included funding for two other projects, and proposing that those would come through our agency. One is public infrastructure for the Minnesota Steel Project in the city of Nashua in Itasca County. He's proposing $6.2 million, which would get us to a total of $30 million in public investment currently. In addition to $23 million that's previously appropriated in 2006, so a total public investment of $53 million is a very exciting project. And, Chairman Rukavina is more familiar with this. I don't know that we need to take the time to explain Minnesota Steel, but it's exciting. This is one portion of the financing necessary for the infrastructure for that project.
Well, Commissioner, the governor must not have thought it was that exciting, because I think the request was for $30 million from bonding, but
we have some differences as to whether or not it's necessary to expend public general fund money for the electric substation. Minnesota Power has indicated that that could be funded using utility rates. I think that's a portion of the difference. The other difference is whether it's appropriate to build a 16-inch pipeline or 24-inch pipeline, Mr. Chairman. And I think those are discussions that we should continue to have.
Representative Mahoney might know better about a 16-inch pipeline or a 24-inch, but and I think the deck, we heard about the deck last night, so we don't have to hear about that. And Minnesota Steel's coming here because I think the DNR or somebody was getting the money, and they changed it to be like properly, appropriately should have been. Do Representatives Moe or Mahoney or Breinert want to say anything about their carrying the bills on it? Representative Mahoney?
I don't have anything further to add on this particular bill that won't be talked about privately or and publicly. It's just a matter of lobbying to bring this bill up and get it funded.
Would Ms. Holly Byron from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities want to come down and say a few words briefly, Ms. Byron, about the program? Commissioner, why don't you stay put there, because I would like to ask you a few questions on this. program. That's all.
Mr. Chair, Holly Thompson from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I just got married, so it's Thompson now, so that's okay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We represent 87 local units of government outside the metro area, and I will be very brief. It may come as no surprise that the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities supports the public infrastructure grant program. We advocated for this program in 2003. It's allocated over $20 million to Greater Minnesota infrastructure projects. We did a survey of our members this year before the beginning of session as to what would most assist our members in economic development of their communities, and the answer consistently was infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure. So we thank you for consideration of $20 million. As well, we also support the redevelopment program. Redevelopment for our communities is very costly. This is a very valuable project. So we again thank you for your consideration of the $20 million for that proposal as well. And I can stand for any questions.
Any questions, Commissioner, I'm just, you know, in the past, people have put in bills for, you know, bioscience projects, and they've gotten funding, and I'm wondering why, you know, a person, commissioner like you that, you know, thinks government maybe should be downsized a little bit, at least that was your philosophy when you were here, now want to start, I mean, any legislator at this table can come in, whether it's Representative Mahoney wanting a clean room at the St. Paul Technical College, or Representative Paz last year asking for funding, I believe, for a bioscience project, or Representative Norton and Welty getting money for biogenomics projects. Why do you want to think you could do a better job than the legislator from the local community that can come in and put in a request, and then we don't need to hire anybody at DEED? Which I would ask the question, who's going to administer these programs, and where are you getting the money for your employees?
Mr. Chairman, let me answer the second question first.
I don't even think I finished my own question, but you understood what I was getting.
Surely. We get a general fund appropriation for administration, so we have a cadre of very experienced staff and a group called the Business and Community Development Division that administers.
But you don't have those. You don't have a bioscience grant program now, there.
We have had it's been funded twice in the past. We would administer it with the same group of people that administer the redevelopment grant program and the business infrastructure grant program. I cannot tell you off the top of my head in what years it was funded, but I believe this would be the third time that the biobusiness program has been funded. Mr. Chairman, it may be a philosophical difference. You know, you have commented before that we have a different view of the role of government. That's probably true. I don't think the government doesn't do wonderful things. I think that there are times when...
I think government can do wonderful things.
I do, too. Maybe a difference is, can we do them the same way we've always done? We believe that competitive grant programs, where a number of communities compete given established criteria, as they do in the public infrastructure program and the redevelopment grant program, are good ways to make funding decisions, rather than kind of translate all funding decisions into individual projects and individual bills. But both the methods can work. This would be the third time that the legislature has appropriated money to these for bioscience infrastructure. We would expect a variety of grants from a variety of communities, and they would be scored according to the criteria that we create, and grants would be made as we have for, I think, about 20 years in some of these programs.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a couple of questions. One is, how is the money distributed geographically across the state? Because when I look at the bills between the bioscience proposal and the Greater Minnesota Business Development and the Greater Minnesota Development Funding, as a suburban legislator who's got an area just waiting to become a bioscience corridor or something, I'm just curious if the suburban sector has something to gain out of this. And the other question would be, well, it's just a comment following on the discussion you've just had. Here at the legislature, at least when specific projects are chosen, the politics are out in the open. And the debate is had about whether a project has merit or not. And so the idea of giving a big chunk of money and having these decisions made over in a department is somewhat concerning, because then there's still politics. It's just they're within the agency. That's how we fund transportation projects right now. And I think there's a concern that, you know, we don't earmark projects here at the legislature, but there's politics going on. We don't see it. And so I don't know if going down this path in this area is necessarily the right way to go. But I'm really curious, as a suburbanite, what do I have to support in these three bills?
Mr. Chairman, Representative...
Can I just interject here, and I guess I would ask, you know, Representative Hartman, the other day we had a bill in here that asked for $250 million of state money for a bioscience project in the metro area. So I guess we could ask what, with a funding scheme that is more grandiose than what the current way we fund university buildings and projects. So I guess we could all, from outside the metro area, ask the same question. But I understand why, because I'm as parochial as anybody.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think, too, that there's a sort of a new generation of legislators here who see three geographic areas in the state. I don't just see it as metro or greater Minnesota. And a lot of wonderful things are happening in Minneapolis and St. Paul that don't do my constituents any good. So if we see a tremendous amount of the bonding bill, a tremendous amount of these type of investments made in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I'm all for it. But I don't know how to explain to Brooklyn Park taxpayer why they should subsidize investments all over the state if they're not seeing some that they can feel too.
Mr. Chairman, let me
address... You don't answer my question.
I'm not sure I can, Mr. Chairman, but I can answer some of Representative Cortman's concerns. Suburban projects are starting to be funded quite frequently in the redevelopment grant program particularly. And I'll take it from memory that we will get to a list of the projects funded over the last few years. And I recall in recent rounds we funded projects in Hopkins, Minnetonka, Bloomington, Dakota County... I can't remember where else. We will, South St. Paul. Mark, do you have a list here?
I do.
Could you bring it down? And then we'll get a list. Why don't we provide a list to the committee administrator, Mr. Chairman, and you can see where the money has been invested. It's a good question. Up until perhaps 10 years ago, there wasn't much investment because there weren't the kinds of projects being done that reuse previous industrial sites. But as sites in communities, first and second ring suburbs, and there have been projects, and I know, recall, in St. Louis Park, the Bell Pole site and others.
We'll just get that list, and
we'll
don't have to
list.
Go through it, and we'll...
All right. But
go ahead, Representative Horton.
The selection issue. We would argue that the selection of projects in these programs is not based on politics, but rather on scoring criteria for things like our private resources leverage, are the pollution and other contamination issues addressed, how many jobs might be created, is there support from the city and county. And we hope that we can move it to a project merit basis rather than what traditionally might be thought of as a political basis. And I think we have gotten good reaction from the community, like the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and League of Minnesota Cities and other development advocates, for the way projects have been selected and funded. We have to balance between applications we get from very sophisticated applicants like the Port Authority of St. Paul and Minneapolis CED, and less sophisticated developers or proposals from small communities. And we work really hard to have the money allocated on the merit of the project rather than on any... traditionally what we thought.
I understand that, but the proposal that you are talking about is this redevelopment grant program, and you're talking about that it's a mix of all over the state, but the way the bill is drafted, it looks like it's just greater Minnesota. So I don't know if we're changing an existing program.
No,
but
more so.
There's two grant proposals. The redevelopment grant is 50% metro and 50% greater Minnesota. Economic development infrastructure is 100%.
The MO, excuse me, Mr. Chair, 2880, the MO bill is...
Is it 50-50 or is that just for greater Minnesota?
50-50, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it does say for greater Minnesota in the bill. The proposal by the agency, and that and currently the development fund is split 50-50. And maybe there isn't a bill introduced, and Representative Moore is just snuck out of his room.
Yes, he did.
Because he drafted it for Greater Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to study those legislators. They're the parochial stuff better. And I think that we need money.
Well, maybe they're trying to make up for the $250 million. I don't know. We don't have a bill introduced yet by a department gel then, obviously. I thought the mobile was your third leg of the stool here, but obviously it isn't.
Let's see. Representative Moe's bill is 2880.
Yes, and does reference...
Line 1.10.
It does reference Greater Minnesota.
And that's not consistent. We would prefer that it be appropriated to be administered under current law, which is 50%.
Right. Which just got to 50%, didn't it, last year in our bill?
2006, I believe, Mr. Chairman.
I thought it was last year. It was 2575. Ms. Bollich, you had requested to speak, but if you're going to speak in favor of it, everybody else has already. You're going to speak against it? Oh, you are? Okay, come on down.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Bollich, and I represent Minnesota Solutions, and we actually developed that program in 1998 and brought it to the legislature, and it operated very successfully as a statewide program for about 3 years, and then under the Ventura administration was diverted entirely to Greater Minnesota, and it was last session, after years of struggle, that we restored the statewide jurisdiction. So that is my concern with the MOLD bill, is that if that were the recommendation sent on to the Capital Investment Committee, that it would essentially be only funding the Greater Minnesota portion.
Thank you for your comment.
Mr. Chairman, the Department...
And yes, I thank you for clarifying that. We did change it last year, Ms. Ballas, back to 50-50.
And the Department supports the 50-50.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, other questions of the author or Commissioner McElroy or Mr. Coleman? If not, thank you very much, then. And I will take Representative Mahoney then. We'll move that House File 20. Representative Mahoney moves House File 2760, be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion. In the omnibus bill, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Welty, is Representative Briner here?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, excuse me. Representative Briner moves House Bill 2879 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And Representative Moe is in here, so Representative Bly moves House Bill 2880.
Mr. Chair, would it be appropriate for me to offer an amendment to strike greater out of line 1.10, or are we...
Maybe we should do that as we move the omnibus bill out of here on Thursday night, we're anticipating. The department probably has a bill that they're going to have somebody else introduce, so that probably will be included in the omnibus bill. Is that Commissioner, Mr. Coleman, or Commissioner, is there someone else carrying your bill without Greater Minnesota in the redevelopment grant program?
The governor has submitted a bill that has all of the capital investment items.
But the governor can't carry bills. He's not in the legislature anymore. He's confused about that, I might add, publicly.
Mr. Chairman, I go back here properly and sit through it.
Do we have an author on the governor's bill, I guess, is the question. That's the legislator. I'd love to get the governor in front of this committee, but he won't come. So.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if the entire bill has been submitted. We will check and get back to your staff later today.
So that bill will be given a hearing then and held over for possible inclusion, and then you can amend it, or you can amend the MOE bill Tuesday night.
Mr. Chair, it may be easier to amend the MOE bill to fit the current law or to have it assigned. We agree with Ms. Bollich that
I guess the law Representative Moe argue why he put the bill in the way he did, and you can argue against it.
Mr. Chair, I'll have to speak with some of my suburban members because my son is swimming in a competition that night, so hopefully I won't be here, but hopefully somebody on behalf of the suburban...
Take a few of your suburban friends with you to the swimming. Okay. With that, maybe Representative McFarland would like to go to the swimming meet with you.
Mr. Bowman has something to add.
And let us vote on this. So, and House File 2880, Representative Sly moves House File 2880. All those in favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Quickly.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make a comment on 2880 real quick. Is the only reference to Greater Minnesota is under the kind of the built summary up on top. There's nothing in the language that actually...
Line 1.10.
No, it is. You're not looking at
it. Yeah, 9.1.2 says Greater Minnesota.
And
but in the body of the appropriation, I don't...
No. Line 1.10 says section for Greater Minnesota redevelopment. It would be confusing to you if you could spend it then in the metro area.
But if it appropriates it to the program without language that restricts use from the program, my view, unless I got Attorney General's opinion elsewhere, that it would be spent 50-50. But I will talk to Representative Mahoney.
Okay. Thank you.
Perfect.
Representative Mahoney moves that House File 2938 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion on the bill. And these are both bonds, so. Well, the 2948, okay. 2938 is a bonding bill. So, Representative Mahoney, and does the mayor want to come down?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members. Thank you for indulging and moving on the schedule, bringing in the mayor and trying to get him out so he can continue to better the city of St. Paul and the venue where you all spend way too much time. Members,
we love St. Paul, and we love the mayor too. I do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We love you back.
Is there
press here? Happy to be in there somewhere.
Mr. Chair, which we'll be as brief as possible. Which one would you like us to take first?
Why don't we take the bonding one? So we have House File 2938 in front of us right now that you moved.
And Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I'll do a little bit of an overview. Both these bills need to be done somewhat together because they address the Minnesota Event District. That is the XL Center, the Riverfront Center, the Riverfront Convention Center, the Wilkins Auditorium, the Historic Minnesota Club, the Ordway Center for the Performing Arts, and they tie in the St. Paul Science Museum. This is a concept that we're trying to make and enhance the ability for us to bring in conventions right now. We have the hockey arena. We have the convention center. Our convention center ends up with an awful lot more trade shows, which do not bring the conventioners who spend 3 or 4 days, hotel, restaurant dollars that enhance the sales tax for the city of St. Paul, and hence a better venue for entertainment for all of us. I can spend a lot of time here talking about the need to repair the funding problem that we have. You have this particular brochure in front of you, and when we do the full run, we will use either city employees, so it will be AFME union members, Mr. Chair, or we will send it out to one of the union houses in St. Paul. I'm going to ask that you take a look at the second page here. Relatively quickly, because I know we've got about 30 bills in front of us, convention centers generally operate at a loss. St. Louis is a $4.5 million operating loss. Milwaukee is a $2.2 million loss. Our St. Paul River Center has to operate at a profit and cannot afford, like all of our competitors, to offer free space to their conventioners. We have to use that $750,000 to pay down the debt. I will I'm going to kind of cut that a little bit short, and I will talk to many of you more as we go along. But I have actually the two children of senators. I hope you won't hold that against these two. The star yesterday, I'm told, was our city council president. So I would ask that our city council president start and then go to our mayor for some comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And actually, I'll be real brief because I know that your time is very short. The mayor is going to sort of go over the overview. Sort of my entire message is that right now the River Center is using its operating dollars to pay down our debt rather than using it for actual operating dollars. And that's why we're before you today, is to look for some relief, because the funding formula that was instituted in 1993 is certainly not sufficient to sustain the building as it is. And right now we're just plowing those operating dollars into our maintenance fund. And so the mayor, I think, has sort of a larger overview for all of you. I'm on the River Center and Convention Visitors Authority, so if you have any questions, I'm here.
Could you identify yourself just
I'm
for this case?
I'm Council President Kathy Lansky. I represent Ward 7 in the city of St. Paul.
Mayor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Chris Coleman. I have the privilege of being mayor of the great city of St. Paul. We are here, in addition to Council President Kathy Lansky, Harry Melander, head of the St. Paul Building Trades, is here with us. Jay Rykunik wanted to be here. She is the president of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, as well as Chris Johnson, president of the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce. Neither of them were able to make it here this afternoon, but they have been at previous hearings relative to this bill. I want to thank you for considering this bill here today. These items were included, or portions thereof were included in the bill that reached the governor's desk last year. The line item, the appropriation, and the bill is on the grounds that he wants some more clarification with respect to the need and how the resources would be applied. So we've come back this year with more clarification with that, hopefully addressing the governor's concerns as well as concerns of the members of the legislative body. We do believe that this is an incredibly important opportunity for the city of St. Paul, and I'll explain a little bit more why. As Representative Mahoney suggested, this is a part of a complex that we call the event, our event district in downtown. This is an incredibly important draw for people across the state of Minnesota. You do have the River Center Convention Center, Roy Wilkins Auditorium, the XL Energy Center, 317 on Rice Park, which is the old Minnesota Club, the Ordway Center, and the Science Museum of Minnesota. These are incredibly important cultural, educational, and entertainment venues. They do provide a destination environment for people across the region, especially throughout the state of Minnesota, whether it's a trip to the XL for the high school tournament, or whether it's a show at the Ordway, the Hmong New Year Festival at the River Center, or the latest exhibits at the Science Museum. This district enriches our entire state. The economic impact of this district is incredibly important as well. There are 4.5 million people that visit the district. Approximately 1,100 people are employed at one of the venues in the district. It generates nearly $200 million worth of economic impact through ticket purchases and other spending. Each time someone comes into town for a convention, as Representative Mahoney suggested, and stays there for several days, they generate on average $318 per day on meals, lodging, entertainment, and related meeting costs. With the additional hope to construct a project at the Cleveland Circle site, which I'll also talk a little bit more about, we believe that this would be able to generate 350 jobs if this request were to be granted, and we believe that we could break down as soon as the fall of 2008. We have the convention coming in September 1st through the 4th. The area of Cleveland Circle, which is directly across the street from the XL Energy Center, will be used as a staging area for that event, but we hope, it is our goal, that once those trucks leave, that we will be able to break ground on a new facility across the street. Each of the organizations that are part of this event district are incredibly important. They work well together. They have come together to support this request because they know it's important to each one of their venues. The challenge before us is that the River Center has this urgent and looming deficit in the capital maintenance fund, as was suggested. The facility has been using the operating revenue to cover year-to-year capital maintenance costs, and by the end of 2009, the fund will be exhausted. As Council President Lansky suggested, the problem starts from the original financing mechanism that was originated in 1993. When the city built the River Center without state assistance, and I want to suggest that this is, if it's not the only one, it is one of the very few centers of this type that was done without state assistance. I believe the only legislative action was the allowance of the half-cent sales tax. But that model created a huge problem that we're seeing the beginning of. Coupled with operating revenues for the new convention center and the loan that was used to construct, the $65 million that was used to construct the facility, it's really put us behind the eight ball. 15 years later, it's clear that the routine maintenance and improvement costs were not adequately considered in the original budget. Until the capital maintenance financing issues of the convention center are addressed, the event district cannot make additional progress. This is how the city would apply those dollars if these two bills were to pass. First of all, we stop using the operating dollars on debt service and start using operating dollars to catch up on the maintenance backlog. We believe we can, if we address some of these issues, we can generate an additional $200,000 annually in income and additional sales tax alone once we begin to address some of these long-term problems. We will begin work on the development of projects within the event district. We can improve the physical connection between the Ordway and the Science Museum. We can begin planning for the Roy Wilkins renovation, which is in desperate need of renovation. We can support the redevelopment of the Cleveland Circle site, again, directly across from the XL, which we believe will be a combination of retail, restaurants, medical office supply, as well as a community ice facility. That will really play off some of the great strengths of the district as we have already seen over the years. I won't get into too much more on the Cleveland Circle unless the committee wishes the opportunity for the Cleveland Circle site. But again, I do believe that we'd be able to break down a construction project there that would bring 350 construction jobs to the area almost immediately. Again, just to reinforce, this is a district. The River Center was built without state assistance, one of the few in the state, if not the only one in the state. This is not competing with other convention facilities across the state. We think that the strength of our capital city, the strength of this event district, would be greatly enhanced with these two bills that they were passed. So I do ask the committee's support. I do believe that we've answered the governor's questions that he raised last year, and I would hope that if it were to reach the governor's desk, it would be signed, not vetoed this year.
Well, members, any... The problem, Mayor, is this, and I'll be quite frank, I mean, I think it was $900,000 a year, and they were built into our tails, too, in this committee budget, which I supported Representative Mahoney and Hausman on. But the governor vetoed it, and who knows what the forecast is going to be at the end of the month. It could be $800 million, $1 billion in debt. So the cash that we used last year that the governor vetoed, the pay is probably not going to be around. So, you know, I don't. How about from September 1st to September 8th, we have a dollar sales tax on a dollar in St. Paul. Could that raise some revenue, you think?
Well, we believe that the mere presence, Chair, of the 45,000 official visitors as well as some unofficial visitors, we believe will generate quite a bit of revenue for the entire state. And I think that that convention that will be coming is a good example of if we invest the resources, we can attract things of national scope. And so whether you put a surcharge out for the convention or didn't, I think we'll be seeing the revenues from that.
And I'm sure we will. Can you keep them down below Forest Lake? They'll scare my people. They don't know it.
We put together some vacation packages in case any of them wish to tour the great North Country.
Okay. All right, Representative Bryan.
Mr. Chair, Mayor Coleman, this is more by way of FYI than any contention with your bill, but the Mankato Civic Center was built totally without any state bonding money, only with the 0.5% local option sales tax.
Mayor Coleman.
Chair, Representative, I appreciate that clarification. I was careful to say I think one of the few, if not the only, so I now know there's at least one other one that's in the service.
And Mr. and Representative Reiner, I have a list of all, like the other 30 that were either the state paid for, and I will make sure that I highlight that one in orange, along with St. Paul's as the only ones that were some that way.
Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Mahoney, if these two bills were passed and the governor approved them, would this be set a new precedent in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, this would not set precedents. This is actually how Minneapolis got their convention center. The $43 million bonding request is how Minneapolis got their convention center paid for. They had $6.5 million a year to pay off their funds, and that's what St. Paul is asking for. Not $7.5 million. They're just asking to do the same. Have state bonds replace city bonds.
Representative Hodge, please.
Thank you. It's been a few years since St. Cloud built their civic center, but I don't believe we had state money either. It was a local sales tax. Thank you.
Actually, I...
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney and Mr. Mayor. I just need clarification on this because I wasn't in the legislature when they originally authorized the dollars to go to the facility. Can you tell me what was the original state investment in the facility, and then if we forgive the loans as you're requesting in here, what is the total cost to the state going to be for this facility?
I would ask if I could, Mr. Smith, our finance director, to come. He could give you a little more thorough history. I'll just turn over to Matt at this point.
Well, Matt, Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee. It's nice to see you again, Mr. Smith. You work for the Department of Revenue. And the whole thing was tied in with the arena, too. So there are bonds being paid by the Wild, right?
There are bonds being paid by the Wild at a tune of about $6.5 million a year.
Mr. Smith can maybe give you a wrap-up here, Representative Wild.
Mr. Chairman, members, the River Center, the convention center, for which the bonding request would pay off the outstanding principal, was financed, I believe, with originally about $55 million worth of bonds issued by the city. And the balance that's remaining on those is just about $43 million or so left. Then there was another question about the arena. And the arena was financed with a combination of bonds that were sold by the city, which, as Mr. Mahoney said, are being paid primarily by the team rent, because the city owns the arena and leases to the team, and then some of the sales tax. Then there was capital contribution from the team tenant, which just went directly into the building and so wasn't financed at all. Then the last component of the Excel Arena financing was a $55 million loan from the state, $17 million of which was forgiven immediately, essentially in recognition of amateur use. And then the city has been retaining the balance of that loan in annual payments back to the state. And so the arena loan forgiveness would be a request for forgiveness of the loan dollars that are going from the city to the state. So, as we said, those dollars can stay in St. Paul and be reinvested into the event district complex itself rather than being paid out as debt service.
So, Mr. Smith, what happens to the Wild payment that they're currently making?
Mr. Chairman, nothing, because there's a separate agreement, lease agreement, between...
So they're paying us the debt, the bond that you issued for the arena by paying you.
Yes. And the team is leasing the arena under a long-term lease agreement, and the city is taking those dollars along with some of the sales taxes that we need to cover both the arena bond and the loan to the state. So if the state loan is forgiven, the only thing that changes is the city will then get to retain those dollars and reinvest them back in the district rather than paying them off to the state.
Okay, we've got the motion on House File 2938 first. Any other questions? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. Motion prevails. And then Representative Mahoney, you've explained House File 2948. So Representative Mahoney moves House File 2948 be recommended to pass and be held over for inclusion in our possible omnibus bill, not the bonding bill.
Correct.
Because that's a cash.
That is correct.
Okay, so that one will stay here with us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Members, we have a meeting, a regular meeting, and then on Thursday, we have our regular meeting and our evening meeting, and our intention is to put any amendments, any language that you want. Representative Portman can have her amendments to delete greater. Any Republican members that want to add something or make a motion on something, we'll put the bill together Thursday night. We have to get it out of here Thursday night. Meeting adjourned.